Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 73, The Secret Alliance. We left off last time with the controversial elevation of Athanasius to the bishopric of Alexandria. In this episode, we will see how the Miletians will attempt to remove him from his see. In order to understand the following events, though, we need to first reorient ourselves to the wider context. The Emperor Constantine stayed in Trier from the autumn of 328 to early 329. It was his last visit to the provinces west of the Balkans. While there, his mother Helena died, as we've discussed before, and the emperor established his oldest living son, the Caesar Constantine II, in the Gallic capital with his own imperial court. The Augustus returned to the Balkans by spring, spending much of the next year campaigning along the Danube. By the following spring, though, the completion of New Rome was at hand. On May 11th, 330, the city of Constantinople was formally dedicated. It would serve as Constantine's new residence and capital for the remainder of his reign. That's all I'm going to say about Constantinople for now. We'll have to delay a proper introduction of New Rome for a few episodes, as I want to keep today's show focused on Athanasius. However, it's important that we take note of Constantinople's completion, as the city is going to fast become relevant to our narrative. With the emperor finally back in the east, Eusebius of Nicomedia could resume his high-end politicking. The imperial return also coincided with another event which dramatically increased Eusebius's influence at court. For it was around this time that the Bishop of Nicomedia became part of the extended imperial family. Eusebius's relative, the former consul Julius Julianus, had a daughter named Basilina. Basilina was wed to Julius Constantius, the younger of the emperor's two half-brothers, perhaps during the festivities which accompanied Constantinople's dedication. The couple produced a son named after his grandfather, Julian, the future emperor Julian the Apostate. Though Basilina died not long after, she did aid the Eusebians in one major way. Eutropius, the bishop of Adrianople in Thrace, was a good friend of the recently exiled Eustathius of Antioch, and an outspoken critic of Eusebius of Nicomedia. Through Basilina's agency, the Eusebians managed to have Eutropius deposed and exiled. Eutropius was succeeded by Lucius, who also opposed the Eusebians, and later suffered the same fate. Despite their recent string of successes, the Eusebian party had still failed to achieve their most important objective, the restoration of Arius as a presbyter in Alexandria. The fact was that, as long as Athanasius was in office, Arius would remain in ecclesiastical limbo for the rest of his life. It was during the summer of 330, then, that Eusebius hit upon a cunning scheme to unseat the Bishop of Alexandria. A Miletian envoy to the imperial court showed up in Constantinople with a petition for the emperor asking for protection against Athanasius's harassment of their churches. However, having no familiarity with the court, the Roman officials turned down their request for an audience. It was then that the schismatics became acquainted with the Bishop of Nicomedia. Eusebius promised the Miletians he would use his influence to secure them an audience with the emperor, provided that they were willing to receive Arius. Now, of course, the Eusebians and the Miletians had nothing of substance in common with one another. The Eusebians were a theologically motivated alliance of bishops, while the Miletians were schismatics separated from the church for reasons other than doctrine. But as the saying goes, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Both groups wanted someone new on the bishop's throne in Alexandria. Therefore, a clandestine alliance was formed. Eusebius would act as the Meletians' secret friend, and together they would work to bring down Athanasius. The new alliance made its first attack not long after. Eusebius advised the Meletians to accuse Athanasius of extortion. Specifically, the Meletians accused Athanasius of imposing an illegal tax on the Egyptians, demanding linen tunics be supplied as part of their obligation to the state. The Meletians further claimed that Athanasius demanded that they be the first to comply with his new tax and supply him with said tunics. This was not a traditional imperial tax, but rather part of Constantine's new subsidies of Christian charity. The emperor channeled imperial largesse through the network of Catholic bishops. In this case, it appears the emperor had given the Bishop of Alexandria money and/or resources to be used for creating tunics, either as clothing for the poor or for liturgical vestments. When word of this accusation reached Athanasius, he decided he needed to go away on an extended visit to the churches of Upper Egypt. While he spent the winter of 330-331 in the Thebaid, Athanasius delegated two presbyters to represent him in Constantinople before the emperor. One of these two was actually a former Meletian named Macarius. Macarius was fiercely loyal to Athanasius. His status as a reconciled Meletian was no doubt calculated to impress the Augustus. It was a symbolic statement that Athanasius was not an intractable obstacle to peace within the church. Constantine interviewed both sides and determined the accusation against Athanasius was false. The emperor then issued a letter to Athanasius which condemned the lead Meletian envoy by name. Following this, Athanasius appears to compress his account of events, as he next says that, in the same letter, the emperor also summoned him to appear at court. In actuality, though, the bishop did not appear before the emperor for almost a year, as we'll get to in a little bit. As mentioned before, while the two presbyters were representing him at court, Athanasius was touring the southern province of the Thebaid. Though this trip was probably motivated in part to avoid being reached by imperial agents, Athanasius did have other reasons for his visit. He needed to introduce himself as metropolitan and pope to the Coptic Christians of the province, and forge ties with their communities. He also needed to counteract the growth of the Meletians in their own backyard. One of the key elements in this contest was the burgeoning monastic movement. We've discussed monasticism before, notably Antony of Egypt, about whom Athanasius will later write a biography. In the past number of decades, monks had become a staple of Christian life in the Egyptian countryside. Both the Orthodox and Meletians had their own monks and monasteries. It was during this time that the great Pachomius, the symbolic founder of communal or cenobitic monasticism, was growing his alliance of monasteries in Egypt. We'll discuss Pachomius and early monasticism in much more detail down the road. What you need to know for now is that the monks were an important, but somewhat unknown, element in the ecclesiastical politics of Egypt. Pachomius and his monks, for instance, while not hostile to the Bishop of Alexandria, did wish to maintain a measure of independence from the clergy. During Athanasius's visit, a local presbyter actually tried to get him to ordain Pachomius himself as a presbyter, and therefore integrate the monastic leader into the official church hierarchy. In response, Pachomius hid himself, and so escaped ordination. Such tensions are understandable, as the monks embodied charismatic, spiritual authority, in contrast to the institutional, official authority of the clergy. We've seen this dynamic before with Cyprian of Carthage and the Confessors. It is therefore one of Athanasius' greatest accomplishments that, over the course of his 45 years in office, he will manage to turn the monastic movement into one of his strongest bases of support. Support, which will later prove vital in saving not just Athanasius' episcopacy, but also his life. For now, though, Athanasius was just beginning to form this alliance, and he seems to have made a decent enough first impression on the monks. Athanasius returned to Alexandria in early 331. By that time, the extortion charge had been dismissed, and Macarius had returned to the city. Athanasius began the year, as he always did, by issuing his festal letter, which reiterated that Easter would be celebrated on April 11th. Sometime after the great feast, Athanasius made a fateful visit to the churches of the Mariottis district, the area around Lake Mariott, just outside the southern end of Alexandria. Note, I do apologize that in an earlier episode I incorrectly stated Lake Mariott lies to the west of Alexandria. I hope you'll forgive my gross geographical error. The villages of the Mariottis had their own presbyters who were under the authority of the Bishop of Alexandria. While visiting the village of Sacontororus, the local presbyter came to Athanasius with a problem. He informed the bishop of the presence of a certain Ischyrus, an illegitimate presbyter who was leading many of the people astray. Ischyrus had been ordained by the schismatic Caluthus, who you'll recall had set himself up as bishop in opposition to Alexander not long before the outbreak of the Arian controversy. Though Caluthus had been reconciled at the Council of Alexandria in 324, the same council found Ischyrus to be disreputable, and did not receive him back as a presbyter. Now Ischyrus was making trouble again, and Athanasius decided to act. What happened next is a matter of intense dispute. According to Athanasius, he sent Macarius, who was traveling with him, back with the village presbyter to summon Ischyrus. When Macarius arrived, he found Ischyrus in his hut, lying sick on his bed. The only other persons present were a catechumen and Ischyrus's father. Macarius informed the would-be presbyter's father that once his son had recovered, he should admonish him to cease and desist all illegal priestly functions. Such is what Athanasius claims is what happened in his own writings. Ischyrus did not give up his pretensions to be a presbyter. Instead, not long after Athanasius' visit to the Mariottis, Ischyrus joined the Miletians of John Arcaph. As it turns out, Ischyrus had a far different version of what had transpired with Macarius. What did Ischyrus claim really happened? He claimed that Macarius had been sent not as a messenger, but as a henchman. Acting on the orders of his bishop, Macarius had broken the communion chalice Ischyrus was using, the sacred cup in which the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ was consecrated and offered. This was a serious accusation from a Christian perspective, and news of it was music to the ears of both the Miletians and their secret ally. When Constantine had dismissed the extortion charge against Athanasius, Eusebius instructed the Miletian envoys to remain within the vicinity of Constantinople and Nicomedia. Once the time came for a second attempt at Athanasius, they would be on hand to represent their case to the emperor. The Ischyrus incident provided that opportunity. In the autumn of 331, the Miletians submitted another petition to the emperor, consisting of four total charges. The first charge was a repetition of the illegal tax of linen tunics. The second was one which the Miletians had long complained about, that Athanasius was ordained bishop below the canonical age. The third charge was that Athanasius had ordered Macarius to break the chalice of Ischyrus. As bad as this was, though, the fourth and final charge was even more serious. The claim made was that while a deacon at the Council of Nicaea, Athanasius had bribed the former imperial master of offices, Philumenus, a charge which was connected to a recent plot to assassinate the emperor. Hence, this final charge was essentially an accusation of treason. The list of charges was both civil and ecclesiastical, a potent mix which Eusebius hoped would be just the right combination to finally turn Constantine against the Coptic Pope. Athanasius could not avoid coming to court this time, and so he sailed north, taking Macarius with him to give his direct testimony. The imperial audience took place at Samothia, a suburb of Nicomedia. Over the next couple of months, Constantine interviewed both sides. As before, the emperor found Athanasius innocent of all charges, dismissing the accusations as unfounded and false. Constantine then wrote a letter to the Alexandrians praising Athanasius as a man of God, while roundly denouncing the Miletians as quarrelsome troublemakers. Rather than send an imperial notary, the emperor gave the letter to Athanasius himself to present to the Christians of Egypt. Though the Miletians had tried to portray him as an obstacle to the emperor's desire for peace, it was they whom the emperor now regarded as the source of strife. By February of 332, the imperial audiences were over, and Athanasius was free to write his festal letter for that year. In this letter, the bishop apologizes to his flock for being late, both in writing the letter itself and returning home. Not only had the imperial investigation delayed him, but both illness and weather had conspired to further delay his return to Alexandria. Athanasius makes it clear, though, that the emperor had come down on his side and the Miletians had been put to shame. Though Athanasius wasn't able to depart for Egypt just yet, he was able to have the festal letter sent home via the agency of one of his own friends at the imperial court, the Praetorian prefect Flavius Ablavius. By spring, Athanasius had finally returned home, and on April 2nd, he celebrated Easter with his congregation. With the Miletians temporarily cowed, Athanasius was able to continue his journeys to the other churches under his authority. Over the winter of 332 to 333, the bishop traveled west to Libya, visiting the churches of the Pentapolis and the Oasis of Ammon. While the purpose of these travels was ostensibly pastoral, modern scholars have suspected Athanasius also had a political purpose as well, namely counteracting the activities of Arius and his followers. Though he had been recalled from exile and rehabilitated, Arius had still not been restored as a presbyter in Alexandria. So for the past 5 years, he had languished in his homeland of Libya. Furthermore, it's also possible that the two Libyan bishops who followed him into exile at Nicaea had resumed their sees by this time, which could have strengthened the Arian position in the region. The reason so many scholars think Athanasius was campaigning against the Arians of Libya is because it was shortly after his visit that Arius decided to appeal to the emperor directly. As Rowan Williams notes, Arius was probably at the end of his tether. In desperation, he petitioned the emperor, lamenting his current state, and provided another personal confession of faith. In addition, Arius also emphasized the mass popular support he had among the Christians of Libya. Whatever he was intending to accomplish with this last claim, Arius had made a near fatal mistake. When Constantine read the petition, he saw in Arius's claims of popular support a not-so-subtle threat of schism. Probably reminded of the Donatus, the emperor resolved to nip in the bud the possibility of a new schism in Libya. Imperial agents delivered the emperor's response to the prefect of Egypt in Alexandria. The emperor had issued two documents. First, a long, angry and abusive letter to Arius and his followers, which was read aloud publicly by the prefect in his palace. Constantine was absolutely furious. Schism within the church threatened the peace of God and therefore the security of the Roman Empire. In the letter, Constantine both ridicules Arius's theology, specifically his denial that the Father and Son share the same essence, as well as the aging Arius's physical appearance and moral character. The emperor associates Arius with the lies of the devil and insults his emaciated and pale appearance, among other things. In addition, the emperor declares punishments for Arius's followers. Laymen from the Arian camp who refuse to re-enter into communion with the church will have their census tax quota increased, while clergy in communion with Arius will be forced to serve as decurions in their local city councils. In addition to this letter, Constantine also sent a shorter one addressed to the bishops and laity of Egypt and Libya. Arius was now to be regarded alongside the great pagan critic of Christianity, Porphyry of Tyre. The Arians would now be branded as Porphyrians. Like Porphyry's anti-Christian tome, the works of Arius were ordered to be burnt, and possession of them was made a capital offense. Whether he intended to or not, Arius had poked the imperial bear, and the response was quick and harsh. However, even though Constantine had just hit Arius with a giant stick, the emperor offered a small carrot at the end of his long letter. He summoned Arius to appear before him at court, where Constantine would either heal his soul or recognize the light within him. Arius evidently answered the summons, because what other choice did he have, though the exact outcome is not known. Arius does not turn up again in the historical record for another 2 years. If Athanasius was hoping to provoke Arius into making a mistake with his visit to Libya, then the Bishop of Alexandria succeeded beyond his expectations. The early months of 333, then, were good times for Athanasius and his supporters. His Miletian opponents had been defeated at court, the Arians were under imperial wrath, and Athanasius' own esteem with the emperor had never been higher. His position as bishop seemed to finally be secure. But of course, Athanasius' opponents were not done with him. Eusebius of Nicomedia and John Arcaph were simply not going to rest until Athanasius had been banished from his see. Sometime later in 333, John Arcaph submitted yet another list of charges to the emperor. The first charge repeated the accusation of breaking the chalice of Ischyrus, although with some new developments. Not only was Athanasius accused of ordering Macarius to break the sacred cup, but in addition, Ischyrus's altar had been overturned, his liturgical books burned, and the breaking of the chalice had occurred during the very offering of the Eucharist itself. As you can see, the anti-Athanasian version of this story has evolved since we first discussed it. Despite these elaborations, the emperor dismissed the first charge. Athanasius had managed to furnish further proof of his innocence. Ischyrus submitted a formal recantation to Athanasius in the presence of members of the Alexandrian and Mariotis clergy. The would-be presbyter now swore he had only cooperated with the Miletians because they had forced him to. He further stated that no chalice was broken and no altar was overturned. The second charge the Miletians presented, however, could not be so easily dismissed. Murder. Yes, you heard that right. The Miletians accused Athanasius of ordering the murder of a fellow bishop, Arsenius of Hypsale in Upper Egypt. The charges allege that Athanasius ordered one of his bishops to first beat Arsenius with leather thongs and then burn him alive in his home. The Miletians claimed to have proof in the form of a severed hand, which they asserted was all that remained of Arsenius. They further claimed that Athanasius had kept the limb for dark, magical purposes. Instead of summoning Athanasius to court as he had done before, though, Constantine decided to defer the case to his half-brother, Flavius Dalmatius. The emperor had recently revived the archaic office of censor and bestowed the title on Dalmatius, making him superior in rank to the Praetorian prefects, though still not a member of the Imperial College. Dalmatius was currently residing in Antioch, overseeing the eastern provinces. The censor wrote to Athanasius, instructing him to prepare his defense. It's unclear if Dalmatius's mandate was to conduct a preliminary civil trial before handing the matter off to a church council, or if Dalmatius was simply tasked with facilitating the investigation in preparation for a church council. Either way, Athanasius's fate would ultimately be decided by a synod of his fellow bishops. The accusation of murder caught Athanasius off guard. It had been some 5 or 6 years since he had even seen Arsenius of Hypsele. It's possible the two men had had an earlier falling out, and that, like Ischyrus, Arsenius had defected to the Miletians. Athanasius wrote to the bishops of Egypt for assistance in tracking down and locating Arsenius. He also sent a trusted deacon south to investigate the Thebaid, where Athanasius suspected the Miletians were hiding Arsenius. A suspicion which proved to be entirely correct. Athanasius's deacon made the acquaintance of some local monks who knew which Miletian monastery Arsenius was hiding at. One of these monks was actually from Hypsele itself, and so could identify Arsenius. However, as the deacon and the others approached the monastery, its presbyter, Pinnes, was tipped off, and he and his fellow Miletian monk, Elias, managed to sneak Arsenius out of the monastery and send him off on a boat down the Nile. Realizing what had happened, Athanasius's deacon then escorted Pinnes and Elias to Alexandria and brought them before the imperial dukes, or military commander, of Egypt. Sufficiently intimidated by the dukes, Pinnes and Elias spilled their guts on the whole affair. Athanasius now knew for certain that Arsenius was alive, and the Miletians were indeed hiding him. Athanasius made sure the report of the dukes was sent to the emperor. However, he still needed to find Arsenius himself if he was going to completely prove his innocence. While Athanasius searched for Arsenius in Lower Egypt, preparations were being made to organize the church council, which would try the Alexandrian bishop. The synod was to meet at Caesarea in Palestine, under the presidency of the local bishop Eusebius, and supervised by the censor Dalmatius. The emperor dispatched letters of summons around late 333 or early 334. The council was planned to meet in the early spring. Other Eusebians in attendance would be Eusebius of Nicomedia himself, Theognis of Nicaea, and the Thracian Theodore of Heraclea Perinthus. The Miletians were also summoned, particularly as witnesses, including monks. Athanasius's enemies wanted to make sure they had all their witnesses available in order to convict. As the council was gathering, though, Athanasius refused to depart for Palestine. The Eusebians saw this as an opportunity to disparage him before the emperor, and so wrote to Constantine. While they had all dutifully followed the imperial instructions and arrived at Caesarea on time, Athanasius had insulted the Augustus by ignoring the summons. Soon, though, these points were made moot. Following their confession to the dukes of Egypt, the Miletian monks Pinnes and Elias sent John Arcaph a letter telling him the jig was up, and Athanasius knew Arsenius was alive and was actively searching for him. They implored John to drop his case against the Bishop of Alexandria. Athanasius managed to intercept this letter and duly forwarded it to the emperor as further proof of his innocence. As for Arsenius himself, Athanasius's relentless search had forced him to flee Egypt for Tyre in Phoenicia. It was in Tyre, though, that the murdered man was at last discovered to be alive. Servants of the provincial governor overheard a conversation at a local inn, which confirmed Arsenius was alive and residing close by. The men reported this to the governor, who quickly apprehended Arsenius. Though he at first tried to deny his identity, the local bishop of Tyre recognized Arsenius, and the bishop of Hypsele was forced to admit that he had in fact not been murdered. The governor's report was received by Athanasius, and he quickly dispatched Macarius to deliver it to the emperor. Upon learning that Arsenius was alive, Constantine canceled the Council of Caesarea and instructed the bishops to return home. Though the Eusebians and Miletians had come close, Athanasius and his supporters had managed to outmaneuver them at the last moment. Athanasius and Macarius communicated these triumphal developments across the Mediterranean in order to gather wider support for Athanasius's position. The effort produced results as Athanasius received letters of commendation from other influential bishops. Even Arsenius himself reconciled to Athanasius. Of course, most importantly of all was the imperial response. Constantine issued a letter where he reiterated his high confidence in Athanasius and again denounced the Miletians. However, this time the emperor went further. Convinced now more than ever that the schismatics were the real source of the conflict, Constantine threatened the Miletians with civil prosecution and punishment if they dared to persist in raising troubles among the Christians of Egypt. The Miletians were sufficiently terrified by the imperial threat that they ceased to attack Athanasius, for the time being. Their leader, John Arcaf, had been thoroughly humiliated by the whole Arsenius affair, and he humbly supplicated himself before the emperor, expressing his repentance. Though Constantine seems to have been mollified, Athanasius knew the peace was only temporary. It was perhaps at this point, then, that Athanasius began to realize the Miletians couldn't be doing all this on their own. The series of ecclesiastical and political events which had transpired over the past 4 years was somewhat outside the reach of John Arcaf and his followers. Someone had to be helping them. However, it would not be until hostilities resumed the following year that the full extent of the forces arrayed against him became fully apparent to Athanasius. Next episode, the conflict between Athanasius and the Miletians will finally reach its climax, as the Bishop of Alexandria comes face to face with his ultimate enemy, Eusebius of Nicomedia.